is Daryl and Jeff. We like movies and music. Some people would even call us buffs, but we wouldn't go that far. First we'll talk about a movie, and later on we'll talk about a record. Sometimes we fight, but usually we don't fight too bad, and mostly we stay friends.
The song play a little bit longer, but I figured people might get confused real quick because it's harder to identify, I think, themes than...
Kind of sounded like whales.
Have you ever listened to that sound? It's called the bloop or something like that, and it's this underwater sound that's inexplicable and all this stuff.
But it's supposed to come from a very large thing.
Yeah, like something that's like too big, like bigger than a whale could be.
Yeah, that's frightening.
Yeah.
Underwater alien?
I'm not going to speculate about what the bloop is. I don't even know if it's called the bloop. So the movie we're doing, this is 10 Things I Hate About You 2.
Everything's an alien to me.
Well, that's technically true, because it's an other, which alien means. There you go.
I'm smart. I know things.
Yo. Okay. It's 10 Things I Hate About You 2. My name's Daryl. I'm sitting here with my friend Jeff. That was the theme song from the movie The Shining, which is the movie we're doing this week. The movie. I was combining movie and music. I blew it.
I blew it.
All right, let's talk. Let's do a plot synopsis. Do you want to do it? Because you've seen this movie more than me.
No.
Okay.
You're better at them every time. I always stumble and stutter.
So, The Shining is about the Torrance family, played by Jack Nicholson, Shelley Duvall, and the kid, and the three of them.
Make it sound like a Western gunslinger.
Yeah, the character, the family goes to. The Outlook Hotel, is that the name of the
Overlook Hotel? I don't know where it's based in.
It's meant to be Colorado.
Okay.
But it's the two hotels are actually in Oregon and
UK.
Yeah, in the United Kingdom, but it's based in Colorado. And he's going to be the caretaker for the winter of this hotel. The first scene, he goes there and he's meeting with the management, and they tell him the story about how one of the old caretakers kind of went nuts, got cabin fever, killed his family. But he's like, "Don't worry, that won't happen to me." They go there and. Slowly things began to unravel, and you also learn two pieces along the way. One, the son, which is Danny?
Danny is his name, yeah.
Danny has a power called Shining, which he and the cook of the hotel talk about in one of the opening scenes.
Is this like telepathy?
I think it's an ability... a bit of telepathy and a bit of like a sort of... historical knowledge or something, because he's not like he's almost telepathic.
Visions.
With the buildings, yeah, so a sort of visioning, and so he gets all these visions. He can see the twins, the Red Rum stuff,
what's the imaginary friend, Tony,
and I was gonna say Tim or Timmy. So him and Tony are talking all the time, and he gets these visions. A lot of these pieces, we can talk about this, but the plot doesn't necessarily,
like, chopped up bodies and blood everywhere,
mm-hmm. Blood out of elevator doors, the two twins. And then slowly, like, the unraveling begins, and, you know...
Jack Nicholson
has like a sort of psychotic break, and he starts seeing visions, but his visions are different because they're all like of the old hotel, of the way it was like in the 20s. He's always at these 20s parties, etc. And then eventually Shelley Duvall also starts having visions.
And towards the very end.
Towards the very end. So like basically the whole hotel is like alive with stuff. And then there's a showdown between Danny and his father kind of outside in this hedge maze. And he...
The chase.
Yeah, the chase. And he sneaks away from there, and Jack Nicholson gets lost and freezes to death. And Shelley Duvall, whose character's name is Wendy, which is something I want to talk about in a minute, but her and Danny escape in a snowcat that was driven up by the cook guy who was killed by Jack. And then, you know, they get out of there in that snowcat, presumably.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a quick plot synopsis.
Here are some things I want to talk about.
Okay.
And I'm going to just list them, and then you can choose.
We'll start picking from them.
First, your issue with the plot.
Yeah.
Second, Kubrick in general.
Sure.
Third, the beef between Stephen King and Kubrick. For Room 237.
Okay.
And I think, conspiracies.
I think we should start with the plot and then the beef between Kubrick and
King,
because those kind of, to me, tie up. And yes. Then we'll move into Kubrick in general and then into the Room 237 stuff.
Good.
So my beef with the plot, and I've lessened so after watching Room 237, but essentially it doesn't make sense.
Also, this is very Halloween-y of us.
Yeah, Halloween.
We're getting into scary mode.
And we're doing Scream next week with Trevor Murphy.
Scream with... Yeah.
But my beef is that basically the plot doesn't it doesn't tie together. There's like cool pieces and they're all suggestive things, and I think those all piece into that Room 237 conspiracy Kubrick stuff. But as a movie, at face value, the movie doesn't really fully hang together. It's super scary and it's like psychologically thrilling, but I feel like pieces...
Do you remember what falls apart for you?
What falls apart is two pieces. Does like... Jack have an ability of shining as well, because him and Danny sort of seem to communicate like cerebrally as well, but that his is different and his visions...
I don't think so. I don't think shining... I think the shining is the communication between people and sometimes the object, which is the hotel.
Okay, so...
And I think what Nicholson gets...
is to do with the fact that he's somehow been there before?
Nicholson, I think it's almost sort of suggested that Nicholson might just be going insane.
Okay.
But then it's also suggested that these are just visions. So that's why Shelley Duvall also has them.
But with Nicholson, there's the suggestion that he has been a past guest of this hotel, because they show his face in that photograph from 1921, July 4th, 1921, and that he... Like, his visions seem to be from that time period and very specifically related to the suggestion that he is somehow, like, has been here before. This isn't his first time here. And there's even plot lines or, like, lines in the dialogue where he says, like, you know, I've got the feeling that this place is very familiar.
That he's some sort of supernatural being.
Yeah, that he's been there. And I guess that doesn't really make sense to me in terms of, like, the psychotic break. And, like, basically...
Because it goes unexplained.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't need to be explained. Because the movie isn't about how the plot fits together.
Sure. I guess, like, for me, I just wish it would. I wish it was, like, all the things that come out in Room 237 plus, like, a movie that hangs together. You know what I mean? Sure. I guess maybe if it hung together, then you wouldn't question those other pieces, and maybe that's not what Kubrick intended, et cetera, et cetera. So maybe that...
But what Kubrick intends, I feel like, is vastly different than what Stephen King intended when he wrote the novel.
Totally. And they have... Well, they don't have beef. Kubrick probably couldn't care less.
Kubrick didn't care less. Stephen King...
was upset.
Continuously. Like, it still thinks it's a bad movie and does not like what Kubrick did to it.
So I was reading a little bit about that, and the two things I came up with was, one, that he doesn't like the portrayal of Wendy, Shelley Duvall's character, that she's sort of this, like, hapless screaming woman throughout the movie, and that he intended her to be, like, much more of a heroine who, like, combats the psychotic break of, like, the male character.
Mm-hmm.
And what was...
He thinks it feels very cold to him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the movie isn't about people overcoming things or in the face of, like, some sort of evil, like, what does the human spirit do? This movie, Kubrick's movie, is much more about other things. And I think that's very important because King's book is about characters. And Kubrick never writes about characters.
Yeah, it's about, like, ideas. Which is interesting because I feel like it's still about what do people do in the face of evil, but it's like a sort of overwhelming and bureaucratic
and
evil.
Almost a historical view.
Yeah.
So I don't think, if you think about almost every single Kubrick movie, he never like gives an S about characters.
Sure.
Every single character is either robotic, like robotic, extremely robotic, or an exaggeration.
Sure.
So like Jack Nicholson is an exaggeration, but early on in the movie, he's just purely robotic.
Yeah.
So you never, Kubrick never wants you to identify with characters.
He just wants you to.
And that's why it feels cold to someone like Stephen King.
That makes sense.
Because I like this, is a leap for me, because I sort of feel like, because I don't know this man, or like I haven't like studied him enough, although I studied him a little bit, but like I always sort of feel like I get the sense that Kubrick feels like that's a cheap way of attracting an audience.
Is to empathize with characters.
It's to make them feel like, oh, I'm just like this person. When really, like, Kubrick wants you to think about the themes more, the symbolism, and like the visuals and stuff like that.
Fair enough. Do you think, what about like, how do you take Full Metal Jacket into that? Because I feel like there is an identifying, maybe, I think you're meant to identify with Matthew Modine's character in Full Metal Jacket.
Sort of, but Matthew Modine is a historically, like, robotic actor.
Yeah. Like, he's kind of a terrible actor. Okay, let's not get into that piece.
And like, and the drill sergeant is like over exaggerated. Like every, like you're either like a robot or you're exaggerated.
Yeah, like Animal Mother. There's a lot of animal mothers.
Yeah,
that's an exaggeration. Yeah. That's, I'm agreeing with you. So I think we've sort of done almost three parts of this, and we're almost on to room 237. Unless there's other pieces you want to talk about.
What do you think about that? Like, what do you think of that as a method of filmmaking?
I like characters, so
I know, that's why I feel like you would have a problem with Kubrick.
And I said this during when we were watching this movie, where I was like, I feel like all of Kubrick's movies are super smart, and like I enjoy them, but I always find them a little bit boring in a way that's hard to articulate. And maybe boring is kind of the wrong word, but like they're always really long. Like, for the most part. None of them are under 2 hours, really. Mm. You know, you're sitting there looking at a long time. And they always have that, like, sort of, like, 70s experimentalism. Experimentalism is maybe the wrong word, but, like, just a weird vibe that, like, is always a bit disconcerting, leaves you on the edge that, I don't know exactly what I'm trying to say. 2001 is, like, is kind of dull at times. It's super, it's beautiful. It's like visually stunning. It was like,
I think it's the best movie that's ever been made.
Yeah, and I think that there's probably good arguments to that, and I'd like to rewatch it. But for me, like, if I'm going to watch like a sort of, like maybe the most experimental film that I've watched where I was like, that is maybe the best movie I've ever seen in my life, was Tree of Life, which is equally about ideas more than it's about people. And it's about like, you know, it's basically about like the nurture nature debate, etc. But like, there's still like characters that you're meant to like, you understand and sympathize with. So those things are done.
It's so funny. Like that movie left me cold.
See, I really liked that movie. I thought it was maybe the best movie I'd ever seen, because it's talking about like big ideas, like similar to Kubrick, where it's like talking about big ideas, but it's done through characters
But it feels very pushy to me, even at just the title, The Tree of Life. You know what I mean? Like I felt the whole time during that movie that I was being pushed into considering basically our human's place in the universe, right?
Yeah.
And whereas Kubrick, it's always suggestions and like work towards your ideas, and he's never like really trying to tell you anything specific.
Sure. I would concede that. And maybe that's just like that I like to be pushed or something. Like I like to have my emotions prodded by movies. We figured this out along the way. Like
I normally do too, actually.
I like to be emotionally manipulated and feel like a certain way.
So do I.
So like watching Kubrick's movies just
sort of... So do most people.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Kubrick is not like... I'd say 90% of people have not seen a lot of his movies. Like,
sure.
I think 2001's like probably, you argue... I mean, it's a filmmaker's film.
They know references because he's so influential.
Yeah. Like, but I don't think most people have seen... I would bet less than 50% of people have seen 2001.
I bet you The Shining's probably his most popular movie.
You probably... Because it fits in the horror genre. And you know what?
It is scary.
Yeah, I was going to say that. It succeeds in being like absolutely terrifying.
Do you remember when we were talking about The Exorcist, though?
And how it wasn't scary?
No, well, maybe, I mean, that was an argument at that point, but, like, we were talking about a different kind of horror movie from a Scream, which we're doing next week.
Yeah.
To like
This is like ahead of its time in terms of being the new style of horror movie, in terms of like it's very taut psychologically and you don't know what's going on.
It's got the jumpy music moments too, and like,
yeah,
just like it's just a big crash and it just shows you like a black screen with like the day, Thursday.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like,
but there's never like, this movie never has like a bad thing that's the thing that's like haunting and reveals itself to be the thing, and that makes it scary throughout because you don't really know what's going on. You know what I mean?
So I guess what I want to get at is, what is the actual scariness of the movie? And I think
it's
essentially I think this movie I might sound just naive totally right now, but I think this movie is about American history. Well, I think it's about the atrocities because of all the references in the movie. So yeah. I think it's about
the atrocities perpetuated by the
Aboriginal genocide that happened, slavery what happens to the black character. I forget his name.
Yeah, the cook guy.
And then patriarchy.
Sure. Well, I think honestly what makes this movie scary is Jack Nicholson's like total like psychotic break, and he almost seems like an abusive father in a certain respect, and that sort of like that like closeness that you have and like the inescapability of that kind of like abuse is terrifying, you know what I mean? And like that scene where he calls Danny over to the bed, and like Danny clearly is like uncomfortable and doesn't want to sit there, and like that conversation is super creepy, super like, it's just plain scary, you know what I mean?
It is scary, and like he makes it scary, and it's supposed to be a scary movie, and Kubrick's not dumb, like he knows he's got to make it kind of scary, but like really when you think about it, it's like this white man who's not like, who's living in this big Overlook Hotel, yeah. And if it's supposed to represent America, like he's just the sole inhabitant with his white family, like that was built on what they called an Indian burial ground.
Yeah,
and he literally strikes down the black man, and then he's just like holding place, and he's trying to avoid the history that takes place there.
Let me,
because it would drive him insane, and eventually does.
Let's pause there. I want to play a clip. It's like the main sort of unhinging of Jack Nicholson when like he catches Wendy like having read his all work and no play stuff, and then he's like she says she wants to take Danny to the doctor, that he needs to get out of here, and he just starts yelling, and that's sort of probably one of the most terrifying parts of the movie. So let's play that. Come back and talk, and we'll get into all that room 237 stuff, and maybe. Yeah, dig into that a little bit. And then this clip is kind of divided up into two parts, so we'll play the second part a little bit later.
Okay.
But yeah, this is when he comes unhinged.
What should be done with him?
I don't know.
I don't think that's true. I think you have some very definite ideas about what should be done with Danny, and I'd like to know what they are.
Well, I think maybe he should be taken to a doctor.
You think maybe he should be taken to a doctor?
Yes.
When do you think maybe he should be taken to a doctor?
As soon as possible.
As soon as possible.
Jack.
You believe his health might be at stake?
Yes.
You are concerned about him.
Yes.
And are you concerned about me?
Of course I am.
Of course you are. Have you ever thought about my responsibilities?
Oh, Jack, what are you talking about?
Have you ever had a single moment's thought about my responsibilities? Have you ever thought for a single solitary moment about my responsibilities to my employers? Has it ever occurred to you that I have agreed to look after the Overlook Hotel until May the 1st? Does it matter to you at all that the owners have placed their complete confidence and trust in me, and that I have signed a letter of agreement, a contract, in which I have accepted that responsibility? You have the slightest idea what a moral and ethical principle is, do you?
Do you?
All right, so, and then she starts backing up the stairs, and then we're going to play the rest of that clip in a minute.
Two things before we get into Room 236.
Yep.
This movie, and all of his movies, at least his post-Spartacus movies, are so well done. Can we just say he's the best?
I mean, I'm not, like, a film buff in the same way that you are, and, like, I haven't taken any film history classes or anything. They always look great. They're shot well.
His visuals and his use of music.
Yeah.
And his themes are, like, unparalleled.
Okay. Conceded.
That's point number one. Point number two, that's, like, he made Shelley Duvall do, like, over 100 takes of that. I'm not joking.
I believe you. I can't remember.
He was horrible to her on set.
And I think he, yeah, he does that in order to, like...
I think two things to
get the performance he's after.
I also think to actually, I think he was aware of his own patriarchy and like him ordering.
And was using that to like elicit the emotions he wanted, kind of.
What, like the feelings of actually being just dominated and ruled over by a white man.
Yeah. You're probably not wrong. What was your second point?
That was the second point.
Okay. Then.
So let's talk about Room 236.
So I think there's basically three main theories.
Did you introduce it?
Okay, it's a documentary about the conspiracy theories, or just theories about the interpretations of The Shining. And there's, I'd say, three main ones that come out in the movie. There's a lot of sort of, I get frustrated with movies like that, where it's just like a loose association of like things, you know what I mean? And be like, this thing, like the person that says the skiing poster looks like a bull. Like in that,
yeah, the subliminal messaging.
That stuff I have a bit tougher time with.
Well, you know what though?
But let's, okay, what?
Okay, so this movie is like nine different, the documentary, Room 237, it's like nine different people with their own different accounts of what they think the meaning of The Shining is and or
things they
conspiracy
were...
theories behind the movie.
Sure.
So some of them seem just totally wild. Some of them like just seem sort of interesting. But I almost feel like that movie, it does two things. One, I think that movie isn't about The Shining. It's about people and conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
Because some of them are so outlandish that you couldn't just like possibly think that this is an actual thing that
Room 237
that the directors want you to consider that could be The Shining could be about. Like, really, it's actually just about this person who's like saying ridiculous things about this movie. So I kind of feel like Room 237 is less about The Shining and more about people
and who and their relationship to Kubrick and how much they like invest in deriving meaning from like his
or just their relationship to conspiracy theories.
Like, okay.
I think the movie's about conspiracy theorists.
Let's not go too far down that wormhole, cuz let's just talk about the most compelling conspiracy theories
but also,
from 237.
Yeah, but my second point before we do that is just that there are compelling conspiracy theories, and then there are just things that straight up just seem legit, like the movie's about references genocide. Yeah, of course it does.
Sure.
But the other thing is that even if most of what people are saying seem ridiculous, the overall point is, I think you're supposed to come away with The Shining is a movie that has a lot of imagery and suggested meanings that aren't necessarily... Like, I think Kubrick does that in his movies, and I think that's legit.
Yeah. I think that the point that I took away from that is that Kubrick is one of the most, like, deliberate filmmakers of all time. So that any choice that you see, like, for instance, like, the way when the food cans or the ball gets rolled to him, and then the next shot is, like, from the opposite angle where, like, this part, like, where the ball rolled down is now closed off and is sitting at the top of something rather than the bottom, like... However you're meant to interpret that is up for debate, but that was a deliberate choice on Kubrick's behalf.
And even just the background visuals.
Yeah.
Like he deliberately uses like deep focused lenses.
Yeah.
And so everything that's within the frame is deliberate. So
yeah.
He's human and he's susceptible to human error, but anything that you're able to see within a shot of a frame
is on purpose.
He's thinking about it. So anything that's in the background, some random food cans in the background, you know, like the name that's on the typewriter,
yeah,
just any everything, every detail, like he's thinking about it. And obviously, I mean,
okay,
so I think you're supposed to come out of that movie with that.
Sure. And I'll concede all of that. So now let's talk about, there's the basically the three ones that to me are the most compelling or the most interesting are the like genocide of American Indians, genocide of Jews during the Holocaust, and the Apollo moon landing
stuff. Let's just talk about the moon landing.
Is there any other pieces in there that you think are...
I think it's interesting that there are people who have done research to the point where they have actually found continuity errors, in quotation marks, of the layout of the building.
Yeah.
And we're like...
Oh, yeah, that they've mapped out the building based on the shots is
insane.
But
the window thing is... because he would be considering that.
Yeah.
So, like, why would... Like, when they walk into one room in one camera angle and walk into the other room, you're supposed to think that they walked into the same room. But really, if you think about the... If you, like, map out the area of the hotel, they walked in, out of a different room than they would have walked into, kind of thing. I think Kubrick would know that.
Yeah. But that stuff, to me... is harder to like find them. Let's slow this train down because there's a lot to unpack.
But let's talk about the moon landing.
Okay, can we talk about one thing first?
Yeah.
Like, I will just concede, and I think the best interpretation of this movie is it's about like what people in power do to people without power.
Sure.
And how like history has shown time and time again that people in power like hurt those that they power over in like horrible ways, and that like the Holocaust and the genocide of the American Indians is all in there on purpose, and that this movie is like a microcosm of that greater problem.
Yeah, and it's worthy of being a horror movie.
Yeah,
yeah.
And that I think that's generally the interpretation, and that like trying to be like it's more about the Holocaust, and I think all that stuff is in there on purpose, and it's just about like, you know, being powerless and being faced against like psychotic and misguided power and what that does.
It's also funny that he makes a movie about American history. And puts it, and where most people would usually tell heroic stories about American history, he puts it under the setting of a horror movie.
Yeah.
And then, like, something like the Cold War, for example, that he covers with Dr. Strangelove, he takes the book that he adapted that from and turns it from a darkly serious novel and turns it into pure slapstick comedy.
Yeah. I agree. He's blurring those lines pretty hard.
So
Moon landing, let's talk about it. What do you want to say?
So there's a theory that Stanley Kubrick, while he was filming 2001: Space Odyssey,
faked the moon landing, or didn't fake the moon landing. There's not evidence. There's not theories about whether people actually landed on the moon or not. But the footage that the American public saw
was shot by Kubrick
in a soundstage by Kubrick
during the sound, like probably on sound stages that he would have already had.
From 2001.
In the production of 2001 Space Odyssey.
And the two main pieces that are suggested is Danny's wearing of an Apollo 11 sweater at one point. Three main pieces. Room 237 is a focus on this movie, and the Earth is 237,000 miles away from the moon, and that's a very deliberate choice because room 237 wasn't even the number of the room in the novel.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third piece is the hexagonal carpet that he's always playing on. Is very reminiscent of like the launch pads for the rockets in the NASA space program.
But there's more in-depth stuff than that because, essentially what one of the people are in this movie, the documentary, are trying to say is that this is, like Kubrick saw this movie as a way, like the script or story as a way of like admitting guilt or something that he...
Had done that.
Had faked this... footage of the moon landing, and that he was under contract and he could never actually just come out and say it, but this was his way of admitting it. And that also, but also that he had a relationship with NASA.
Yeah.
He's used technology and cameras that NASA uses, like legitimately.
Yeah.
He's taken cameras, like those wide lenses cameras that he uses to capture light and capture like deep focus and stuff.
So what is your...
And people and scientists from NASA always claim that his like spaceships and his depiction of outer space are the most realistic ever, down to the most specific details. So everybody at NASA was always like really impressed with Kubrick's.
So I guess my question is...
I think it's baloney.
Okay, I was going to ask you what's your point, but so your point is that you don't think any of that is in there. Do you think...
You know what my overall point is?
Yeah. No, I don't, but what is
it? So, you know the maze that's outside of the hotel?
Yeah.
That maze is not in the
Yeah, totally.
In the story. It's Stephen King's novel.
Yeah.
What happens in a maze?
You get lost.
You get lost. You go down different routes and find that they're dead ends.
Yeah.
I almost feel like the maze is a deliberate symbol and metaphor that was put in to this movie because Kubrick knew that people would dissect it and go down different places with the imagery and just whatever ideas that they might come up with what this movie means. Because obviously the movie is not just a straight horror. Like, I think everyone can agree that.
Yeah.
He's not just trying to make a straight
it's horror, not Scream.
Horror narrative.
Yeah.
So, I kind of feel like the maze is... Why would he put a maze in this story for no reason? Just for the pure plot point of, like...
I think that's, like, a worthwhile point, and that, like, that labyrinth is clear. I mean, there's...
That's a huge production piece that you would have to... Like, it's, like, a huge thing to put a giant maze in this movie. It's not just, like, oh, then they get chased in the maze at the end. Like, that's how he gets, like, psychs out his dad, and they saves the day. Like, no, that's not why they put a maze in. There's a deliberate reason... Why they put a maze? Sorry, it's pretty psyched.
This is the like most upset. Upset's not the right word, but the most like I can't get you to say jack all about Stand By Me, except who cares,
right?
And then we get into Kubrick, and all of a sudden Jeff's really excited. You can't shut him up for the life of you. We should probably get moving on in a little bit.
All right.
So why don't you finish up any sort of theorems, things you want to talk about? We'll play one more clip, then we'll play some Danny Brown, then we'll move along.
So yeah. You go down wrong routes on a maze, ends up dead ends, but still those things are presented, those alleyways are presented to you. And I think that's a deliberate thing in the movie. I think there's imagery. I think there are things in the script.
I totally concede that he's...
That you can go down different routes and interpret this movie different ways.
I think, yeah, I totally agree that everything that's in there is deliberate and that he wants people to, like, make leaps based on things that he's put in there. I think the leaps that some people make are... dumb,
ridiculous.
Or some are better than others. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So let's play this final clip. It's the sort of scene where he's yelling at her up the stairs, etc. And then sort of the culmination of like the terrifying part, except for when he's quoting the three little pigs and chopping the door down. And that part's pretty scary. And the here's Johnny part. And then we're going to play Danny Brown Triple X. I should mention that both of these pieces that are going to be played back to back have some inappropriate language or strong language.
What's your favorite Kubrick movie?
Probably Full Metal Jacket, but because that's because I like Vietnam generally a lot.
I watched it for the first time with you last summer.
Yeah.
I hadn't watched it before. It's awesome.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. I think that, like, basically the way...
Way better than, like, Platoon or...
Well, and it turns, like, the narrative of, like, war films on their head, and that's why it's the best, and sort of, like, unpacks the psychology of war, that it's not a crucible of men, that it trains people to be killers and they kill.
I kind of think Apocalypse Now did that.
I think Apocalypse Now did that. I agree, but less in an overtly, like, it used war as a backdrop for, like, a psychological undoing.
Human
traits, as opposed
too.
To talking about how war creates a psychological undoing.
Yeah, that's fair.
Here's a scene from The Shining.
To you, what would happen to my future if I were to fail to live up to my responsibilities? Has that ever occurred to you? Has it?
Stay away from me.
Why?
I just want to go back to my room.
Why?
I'm very confused. I just need a chance to think things over.
You've had your whole fucking life to think things over. What good's a few minutes more gonna do you now?
Stay away from me. Please. Don't hurt me.
I'm not gonna hurt you.
Stay away from me.
Wendy.
Stay away.
Darling. Light of my life. I'm not gonna hurt you. You didn't let me finish my sentence. I said, I'm not gonna hurt you. I'm just gonna bash your brains in. I'm gonna bash them right the fuck in.
Stay away from me. Don't hurt me.
I'm not gonna hurt you.
Stay away from me.
So we're gonna cut it a little bit short because we wanted to talk about one last thing. I mentioned that her name is Wendy, and right there he says, Wendy... period, darling, and you're meant to assume he means darling as in a term of endearment. But Wendy Darling is the name of the Wendy character in Peter Pan, which wasn't a name before Peter Pan, so to me the choice of the name Wendy is very deliberate, and a very deliberate reference to Peter Pan.
Yes.
And you had a theory on that. I didn't have any theories, I just noticed it.
If you look in the movie, there are a lot of references to fantastical characters and children's movie characters, and just like American pop culture. So there's like Disney references. There's like images of like Disney characters on like Danny's wall and stuff like that, and he's wearing a Mickey Mouse sweater. That could be a Peter Pan reference, stuff like that. I kind of feel like those are references that maybe suggest, again, like the American history and maybe a way of like
a Disney-fied history kind of thing.
And like they tried to maybe, you know, what would be the word I'm looking for? But just make light of the American history and sort of try to cover it up and like distract.
Yeah.
I guess it would be the word with like all this entertainment and the rise of pop culture and this fluffy, you know, Disney America.
Yep. Well, there are even like Aboriginal characters in like the Disney Peter Pan that are like, you know, treated very lightly, and they like all dress up as Indians and walk around, and it's sort of treated as like it's a very fun thing. Mm-hmm. Let's play some Danny Brown. We're running out of time.
Jack!
This is Triple X off the album Triple X. Here we go. It's got some strong language, so be prepared.
Or whatever.
30. Check. Colder than them rich, they fed slaves. Meet a rappers like water to raves. AKs with bayonets on deck. Rap my sack, sort of like Squidward and his clarinet. I'm in your bitch mouth, but she fantasizing. Staring at the skinny, said it's so tantalizing. Dog, I'm strategizing, plotting on the throne. Master of the ace, sitting on chrome. Dark nights, trying to sleep, stomach on fire. Delusion out from hunger, so I couldn't get tired. Imagining the equalizer going from green to red. Words that rhyme together just appear all in my head. And I'm sorta like Neo with the Matrix code. Try to escape it, hoping the drugs are not my soul. Say I'm getting old, time's running out. Repeating instrumentals, trying to figure patterns out. I never leave the house, ain't slept in 3 days. Popping pills, writing, drinking and smoking hay. Weaving kicks and snares, trying to dodge these hooks. Keeping it original, something that's overlooked. The way a nigga go, I might go out like Sam Cooke. I'm locked up, calling home for money, yelling my bucks. Cause if this shit don't work, nigga, I feel that life. Turn into these drugs, now these drugs turn my life. And it's the downward spiral, got me suicidal. But too scared to do it, so these pills will be the rival. Surpassing all my idols, took the wrong turn. But can't go back now, so let the blunt burn. Cause now it's my turn if I fuck it all up. It took a while to get here, now I depend on these drugs. I took a while to get here, now I depend on these drugs.
Woo! Okay, first question.
Go.
What does tat mean?
He says check.
Check?
Yeah.
But he just says it like tat?
Yeah.
Every time.
Yeah.
Triple X.
Well, first let's say Danny Brown's coming to Halifax.
Playing Pog Explosion. On Saturday, October 20th.
You can never be a rapper.
I'm actually a very good rapper. Better than you.
No way. You want to freestyle right now?
Nope.
Let's pretend like this is Sway in the Morning.
We are going to figure out a way to... We'll do... you're a pretty good rapper. I'm a good rapper too, though.
And we're both really good rappers.
We're good. I've seen... Okay, so this is a story. One time we were at a karaoke party, and I had imbibed some not booze. And
sure.
Was sitting there, and Jeff was performing Gangster's Paradise.
Did you say it was karaoke?
Yeah, it was karaoke. Yeah. And I had a moment where I forgot that it wasn't Coolio doing it. And I was just like, this song's really good. And this rapper is killing it. And then looked over and it was just Jeff killing it. And then I was like, I'm really high. I need to chill out. This is really stupid. So that happened. But the point being is I think we're both pretty good.
Yeah, you rapped at your wedding? You got up on the table?
No, did I?
Yeah, I got a picture on my phone.
I forgot about that part. That's when it gets fuzzy.
And like a lot of tables, and you almost broke them all.
Okay.
But everyone was just like into it.
So, Danny Brown is also a rapper, and he's coming to Halifax Pop Explosion. And
we're both psyched. We're both
psyched. I like Triple X the best. I like it better than old. I think I like the sort of weirdness of Triple X, like, better than, like, the party jams, like, drinking and smoking, smoking and... And I think he sort of got pigeonholed into that a little bit because that's the songs that got really popular at festivals.
I think the exact opposite.
You think he deliberately wanted...
I think old is a much richer lyrical album than... I think Triple X has much more of the "my penis is so big."
Yeah, I always feel like that's a joke, though. Like, it's this weird, like, play on hip-hop culture.
It's his crutch.
Okay, maybe.
Like, just like, my penis is so big, and this is what I'm going to do to this woman about it.
Okay, sure.
Something sounds weird.
Yeah, you're maybe just try switching microphones because that one sounded all wacky-dacky.
Hold on.
So my beef is the wrong word, but
I'm gonna. You hear me in your headphones?
Yeah.
Legit.
Same jazz. Yeah, it was more legit than ever before, but...
Rap, actually, not jazz.
Here is a thing that I want to tell you about the headphones thing, is you have the same headphones, and they equally work. So if you can hear you in your headphones, you can assume that I can hear you in my headphones. So there's no need to ask
the
question.
Plug-in, the plug-in situation?
No need to ask, ever. If you can hear you, I can hear you. Same headphones.
Yeah, but yours might be unplugged or something.
Yeah, but if I couldn't hear me... Then I would also, if I can hear
me. Or maybe this is like an autonomous system that I have with my headphones and my microphone.
I understand that you're trying to play devil's advocate. Trust me, because I always operate the technical side of things. That if you can hear you in your headphones, I can also hear you and all is well.
I trust you.
So
I just don't trust accidents of the brain.
You don't need to ask the question ever again. Danny Brown. You like old better. I prefer Triple X. You think there's too many penis jokes in Triple X. I think that they're sort of funny in a play on hip-hop culture. I think there's too much talking about drugs.
It can be funny, but it's also... So first of all, well, let's get into it. It's wildly offensive.
Yeah.
A lot of the things he says.
Talking to Jules about this morning. Is it offensive in the same way that like Slim Shady LP is offensive, though?
It's rarely as overtly violent.
It's misogynistic, like crazy.
But it's misogynistic, it's crazy.
Fair enough. Do you think that that's a play on hip-hop culture, or he doesn't care and he's just saying stuff? I think he's being deliberately outrageous, obviously.
Well, okay. Here's the bigger picture that we're going to get to. Post-internet rap.
Yeah.
I think post-internet rap, how would I define that? I'm not sure yet. We'll talk about that after. But I think that it is aware of itself and aware of its own criticisms, but still... throws them aside and falls like prey to the same criticism.
Sure, it does the things it's criticized for.
So I don't think Danny Brown is unaware of like how he's
perceived
and like the things that he's saying and how they will be perceived through media.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that he'll sometimes probably just not think about it,
or he'll think about it and perceive
or just
anyway.
Do it anyway. Yeah.
So why is this record if it's all those
and do
things?
It anyway? Not as a not as any sort of critique or like. Just do it anyways because he thinks it's funny or whatever.
If this record is all those things, why is it so critically acclaimed?
I think this record is critically acclaimed because of...
You couldn't be a rapper.
Because of his persona and voice, first of all.
Yeah.
His look.
Yeah.
His use of different voices. That's okay. Not just like the high-pitched, like Cypress Hill-y kind of stuff. And the diversity of beats.
Okay. And I do think there's something to be said.
There are beats on here that sound like Fortek could make the beats, or Boards of Canada, and then like A-Track, and then...
They're definitely weird.
They're all over the place.
I think that there's a humbleness about this record, too, that's really funny. Or like, humbleness is maybe the...
Well, he's got a broken front tooth.
He's got a broken front tooth. There's that whole song, Lie For, where he's talking about how much money he's got, and then he's just saying that he's totally lying and he has no money at all.
Yeah.
And I think that's like... Those little pieces are different than the bulk of hip-hop. And I think that that's really interesting.
And this album is about how old he is, too.
Yeah. And I think that Danny Brown...
Triple X stands for 30. He's 30 years old.
Old stands for also the old Danny Brown, but also that he's getting older.
Yeah.
Have you watched the noisy interviews that he does with ASAP Rocky, where they're talking back and forth?
Yeah, he's hilarious.
He's super funny. They're both crazy offensive.
Yeah.
But he, at least, is funny. And... I also get the perception that he's really smart. Like, ASAP Rocky comes across pretty dumb to me in that, but that, like, Danny Brown at least, like, has, like, absorbed a lot of culture and, like, is informed about, like, lots of different things that are going on. And, like, the music that he knows is, like, really diverse. He talked about how this record, I think it was this record, he was trying to make it sound like Joy Division or something like that.
Yeah, well, that's the thing about, that's sort of like a, when I say post-internet, that's what I mean. Because rap has always been sort of, like, highly referential.
Yeah.
But now because of internet, it's just become, like, the things that you could reference are just vast.
So right? Broad, because anyone can Google
like,
them.
Rap has always been, like, it's always been, like, you have to, like, say something about pop culture. I mean, like, it's like the Eminem thing. But, like, now, like, it's almost like the more weird your references are, like, the better it is.
Yeah.
So Danny Brown's like, I've got this weird haircut, and I listen to Radiohead, and... I watched the needle drop on YouTube, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like that's like, and we think that's cool.
I do think Danny Brown's cool. I think he's a nice guy and he's funny too, which is like.
I always feel like the moment, like he sort of like stands in as like maybe the biggest like post internet rap like figurehead, because he's sort of he took the torch from like the late 90s, early 2000s rappers.
Rappers?
Because he was going to sign to 50 Cent's label.
Yep.
He was going to be on G-Unit just because 50 Cent heard his tape and loved how he sounded. But do you know this story?
Nope.
But when Danny Brown showed up to meet 50 Cent, 50 Cent wouldn't talk to him because he was wearing skinny jeans, had half of his head shaved and like straightened hair, and just looked
like a hipster kind
like of? A hipster kid.
Yeah.
And 50 Cent was just like, I don't even want to talk to you. but 50 Cent is nothing now. And Danny Brown's like the coolest thing.
And Danny Brown was on it. He was aware.
Yeah.
What do I want to talk about? Is Danny Brown the best guest verse guy you can get?
Yes.
I think that that's totally the case too.
No.
Who's better?
Andre 3000.
Okay. But his guest verses basically between Triple X and Old, he was knocking them out of the park one after the other. Like his verse on One Train, on ASAP Rocky's One Train, his verse on Charlie XCX's What I Like.
LP.
Yeah, and his verse on the LP record.
You know it's a really great verse?
What's that?
His featured guest verse on the Insane Clown Posse. That Insane Clown Posse song.
Yeah, I haven't heard that.
That song is terrible, but as soon as he comes in, it's awesome. You haven't heard it?
No.
Oh, it's so good.
Well, let's encourage everybody, including myself, to go look it up. Do you know the name
of
the song?
I don't know the name of the song. I think it's the only... There is a video, and I think it's the only song that those two are...
If you Google ICP and D. Brown, you're going to get it.
You're going to get it.
Or
you might get those interviews that they did with each other.
Is his verses so good? Like, it's his cadence and his, like, timbre of his voice, right?
Yep.
Because he comes in, he always comes in a bit off kilter and, like, immediately draws attention to himself. And then, like, the timbre
he's
of his
like
voice.
He's like an updated Old Dirty Bastard.
Yeah. But I think funnier or like more like
a more traditional rapping actually.
Okay,
because like Old Dirty Bastard would just
be totally nuts.
Yeah, he'd fall behind the beat. He would just say gibberish or grunts.
Should we play another Danny Brown song and then come back and chat?
What song are you gonna play?
I was gonna play Rockstar because you talked about all these references and this one is like chock full of references.
This would be a good one to play.
And then maybe yeah. Again, be warned, strong language. It's Danny Brown. It's a hip-hop song.
Play the whole song. It's only 2 minutes.
Okay, and we'll come back and we'll keep talking about old Danny Brown.
Brown blessed the mic like a Zantai. Butt up the size of a banzai. Kick it like Muay Thai. Flow like sci-fi in high def. I'm righteous and still busting out up on that bitch chest. The verbal folklore been explored and employed by none other than them foes with the gold. And them bankrolls exploding. Ya bitch and my target when I shoot my load. Bullseye, my eyes tight-eyed. Fried off the same shit that rock stars died from. Smoke something with your man, bitch. Like Wyclef used to sell the cannabis. Manuscript, sick shit, prescription, addiction. Slipping out a roll off the counter in my kitchen. Tripping off the shit to have Brian Wilson flipping. Experiment so much, it's a miracle I'm living. And I'ma die like a rock star. Die like a rock star. I'ma die like a rock star. Die like a rock star. I'ma die like a rock star. I'ma die like a rock star. I'ma die like a rock star. Bitch, I wanna party like Chris Farley. Shot a Hennessy, spike the wits of Molly. Tell mommy I'm sorry, God bless my soul. My life is so sublime, going out like Brad Noor. I got that Kurt Cobain type of mind frame. Feeling like Keith Moon shrooms in my dressing room. Basquiat freestyle, feeling like Jimi Hendrix and Anna Nicole Mouth. Reverend Phoenix 93 VIP with some drugged up porn hoes all around me like Terry Diver, Linda Wong, all in hell having orgies with our horns grow along. Cause bitch I'm Frankie Lyman, Heath Ledger hyped up in a jacuzzi doing that Jim Belushi. With Brittany Murphy, we blowing her sheet. I'ma die like a...
What's your favorite one? favorite reference in that whole song?
River Phoenix.
I'm a big fan of the Frankie Lyman one, because that's like one of the weirdest.
This is an offensive song to say what's your favorite about.
Yeah, I guess I'm like, which one is the most obscure and the most interesting to pick?
But this is also just like, well, he's all over the map. Like Anna Nicole Smith.
Yeah.
Frankie Lyman, Heath Ledger.
It's basically everybody. You had one big
Basquiat.
Point. Yeah, I never got that line until today. I know who Basquiat is. I didn't catch his pronunciation of Basquiat. You know what I mean? Jean-Michel Basquiat.
So, like, two things. People want references now. This song's a little overboard, and basically, it's like a song for me and you.
Yeah, it's sort of like the
17-year-old kids who are listening to this song. They don't know who Basquiat is.
Probably. No, they want to hear.
They don't know who River
Blunt Phoenix after is. Blunt.
Yeah.
You want a main point you want to make about Danny Brown before we move along?
Well, it's interesting. It's another like weird like modern like or postmodern rap sort of point, because it's interesting, you know, how self-aware rap is now.
Yep.
And sort of intelligent, at least in its references, you know what I mean? And its self-awareness. But it's gone way far into shock rap, which I think is really weird in this day, like where things are getting more, like, for lack of a better term, politically correct.
Where everything else is moving in a political...
Everything else is moving...
That hip-hop is moving...
That hip-hop is moving as far away from that as possible.
I wonder if that makes it, like, the new rebellious music, if that makes sense. Like, it's the stuff your parents still don't want you to listen to, because it's, like...
Well, it used to just be... rap used to be considered rebellious music just for purely racist reasons.
Yeah.
Like...
Do you think now it is, though, because it's, like, the stuff that's willing to, like, say stuff that no other music really is, kind of thing? Or, like... I don't know.
I do think a lot of it is shock rap is an appropriate genre title, because it's just meant to shock with no actual value behind it.
Yeah.
Other than just the provocation.
So that being said, what is Danny Brown's value? Because I do think he's valuable.
Well, because all the best of today's rappers are just crazy. Contradictory.
Okay.
Like, in the same way Tupac was, but, like, just in so many different ways. Like, Kanye, for example.
Yeah.
Can just, like, say the worst things and the most ignorant things and then the most enlightening things and be, like, super creative. And, like, it's just all over the map.
Yeah.
It's really just rich.
And you think that that's Danny Brown's thing as well?
Danny Brown's, like, one of the best.
Interesting,
intelligent things, stupid things. Like, he says interesting, intelligent things. He makes ridiculous references. He's got... extreme charisma.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I do not ever want to listen to, like, backpack rap, ever. Like, any rap that's just, like, taking it back to its pure form.
Yeah.
You know, like, that stuff is the most boring. Who cares about that?
Yeah.
But, like, a lot of people do care about that, but, like...
Who's the biggest backpack rapper going right now? And maybe explain that for people who don't know what that is.
Going right now? I don't even know. But it's, like, people who are doing, like... It's like Jurassic 5 type stuff.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like Michael Fronte. That kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But it's also like...
Tribe Called Quest backpack rap?
If I'm going to be honest, sort of... Like, they were like... That was the... What was their tribe called? Quest, obviously. But, like, there was, like... De La Soul. Like, what were they called?
I don't know.
They had, like, De La Soul. And
like, it was a crew.
There was a crew, like, Jungle Brothers. They had, like, a name. But they were like the original. That was an original thing back then.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. And it's different now. And Q-Tip's not even close to being like that these days. But anyways, you know what's like really like this these days? It's like the golden era hip hop stuff. It's most Canadian rap.
Oh yeah, Canadian rap is terrible.
It's actually changing now. Like there are some cool stuff. Like I think Cam Smith is cool. And,
yeah,
you know, like there people are sort of like doing some different stuff now. But like for at least like the most of the 2000s, it was just like really bad, like
conscious
DJ Premier type beats, and like
it's bad. Let's play. Okay, let's talk about what we're gonna talk about next week. Let's play one more
song.
Not
that DJ Premier is bad, but like just trying to ape that stuff over and over again, it's really bad.
And final thoughts on Danny Brown. So we are doing next week, Scream, and Marilyn Manson, right?
Yeah, it's our Halloween episode.
So I'm very apprehensive about Marilyn Manson. I'm
apprehensive about Scream, man.
Scream I can get down with. You're going to be okay. Scream terrified me when I was 13.
And it's terrified me.
Stabbing. Yeah, lots of stabbing. But it's also goofy. What's that guy's name, Matthew Lillard? Mm-hmm. I watched a movie with him the other day.
He's a slick punk, right?
He's a slick punk. He's also...
Is that how you pronounce that?
Yeah, it's totally how you pronounce it. You know your movies. Slick punk. And we are doing... What's the album?
I don't even know the album, actually.
It's the one with, like, Beautiful People on it and stuff.
These are both picks by Trevor Murphy, who hosts the show after
us. Who really likes Marilyn Manson, and who I've come more to respect as a person, like... But I'm
Trevor?
Trevor Murphy. Marilyn Manson, but I'm still incredibly skeptical that I can enjoy that music at all.
I like the song The Beautiful People.
All right, well, maybe you and him could talk about it.
Whoa.
Final thoughts on Danny Brown.
One of the best guys going. Super psyched for his show. But, you know, as usual, it's complicated.
What song do you want to hear?
I wouldn't mind hearing Radio Song. I really like Radio Song.
Okay, we're going to play Radio Song. I also think that this album is very front-loaded and that it's hard. I never make it to, like, song 18.
The beats in the back half, though, are really interesting. Like, it sounds like he's, like, doing Fortet beats or Border to Canada. Like, just all over the place.
Okay, this is Radio Song. We're out of here. You've been listening to 10 Things I Hate About You, too. Always got to do something.
This is anti-cling wrap, nigga, wear the green net. Wrist, I take your sweat, I had the balls the size of bean bags. Not what you used to, bitch, I rep the bruiser. And the label fools go, jeans with Medusas. Bitches wanna scoop us, get pussy like loofahs. Y'all niggas losers, cop clothes from them boosters. Hoes wanna choose up, of course they gon' choose us. So though you need a stylist, I so you need a toter. These stupid ass niggas wouldn't know what to do, so they copy whack.